Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners. Care of Nature Now at kptz.org.
Hello, this is Deborah Kelso, host of this edition of Nature Now for the second week of May. This week, we are very happy to have for you part two of our field recording exploring the coast with our guide, Nam Su, looking for seaweed. Nam is a habitat biologist with the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife and especially knowledgeable about our native seaweeds. And we had great fun learning more about seaweed with him last month, along with getting to sample some. Meg Amos, our good friend and fellow seaweed enthusiast, joined us as our recorder. But before we start the main part of the program, let's first hear our mystery sound of the week. A big hint for this sound is that it can be heard along the tidal flats. We'll play it again at the end of the program and tell you more about it. Last time we did this interview, we got so wrapped up in the biology of seaweed and this and that that we didn't even get down to the beach to identify seaweed. So we are now right at the beach edge, and we're so happy to have Nam and Meg with us again. And as we were walking over here, Nam's like, oh, look at that, look at this. And it was like, no, we have to get this on the recorder. So Nam, what are we seeing?
Yeah. It's hard for me to contain myself when there's so much good algae out here. And so, like you said, we're here at Point Hudson. We're in this back lagoon behind a spit where a lot of the drift algae from the storms collect. I'll reiterate the reason why I like coming in here is because everything here is typically ripped up from the storm, so I don't feel bad about collecting it and whatnot. It's all just drift algae at this point. And we're seeing lots of really beautiful specimens. I brought Meg and Deb down here into the water. We're standing in about 2 inches of water where the actual specimens are suspended in the water, where we can see them, their growth form and their beauty and see them in all their beauty. And actually, I noticed another really beautiful one right over here behind Meg. This is a fresher specimen of what we were just looking at.
Oh, wow. That's incredible.
Just the branching patterns on this red, it belongs to a genus called Deliceria. The common name, I think it's red wing, I believe. There are a lot of different common names for these.
Well, as with plants, it's hard to know them by the common names.
But, absolutely. And actually, I think in the book I just showed you, Pacific Seaweeds, I think I read that they just changed the genus name on this one too.
Oh, well, what's new? I mean, that's happening everywhere. Look at that beautiful branching that we've got.
And if I can describe it a little bit, you know, so some of the most beautiful algae we'll see are the reds. They're really fine and very lacy. And because of that, the best way to identify these reds is based on their branching pattern. And on this one in particular, you will notice that the new blades, the new branches, are all stemming off a middle line. They're not coming off the edge of these blades, the main blades, they're coming off the midrib. And then if you look closer, the smaller ones are also coming off a midrib of the smaller branches. And there's this very, I always say, it's very M.C. Escher-esque. You have these fractal patterns here in their branching. And it's absolutely stunning. And I think we will take some pictures, or I'll send you all some pictures to show with the listeners so they get also the visual aspect of this beautiful algae.
Yeah. What is this that we're seeing that's floating? And like you mentioned before, a lot of them have float bladders, but this one looks like it's not a bladder so much as pockets of air that have gathered.
Yeah, that's a very good question. And as a matter of fact, we have some other specimens here that you see are transparent and white. And so, as I mentioned earlier, there's a high diversity and differences in the way these algae look, but they also exhibit a high amount of phenotypic plasticity, or the ability to change their growth habits and form based on environmental factors. What we're looking at here is not that case, actually, but because we're looking at an area that drift algae that is ripped up and on, they're basically decaying, they're on their way out, we're seeing various stages of that decay.
Oh.
And so you're looking at a bleached type of algae here, and this one is actually a Turkish towel.
Oh, yes.
And it's bleached. I can tell it's a Turkish towel because of these nubs on that blade. And actually, right over here is a non-bleached specimen of that. Oh, that's pretty gone, too. But I will point out another one, but that's a really good observation.
I've seen them, and they're a beautiful pinky red when they're fresh, right?
Oh, and we will definitely... Oh, here's a piece. I didn't even have to move. I just had to turn my head. But here's a piece that's not bleached. But if you look at it, they look identical except one, you know, of course, because it's no longer growing, all of those photosynthetic pigments, they start degrading. Uh-huh. And so it becomes transparent. It's almost like coral bleaching, right? You have algal bleaching here. And on that note, I actually want to point out another really cool specimen that I think is behind Meg. And we're standing in, like,
a 10
square foot area, and I'm seeing so much here. The one that's behind Meg is this one. Kind of on the note of bleaching, this is an algae that is well known for bleaching other algae. The common name is called witch's hair. Its genus is Desmorestia. And so this is one of the acid weeds. It's highly acidic. And so when it's in contact, especially out of the water with other algae, it tends to bleach them. And what's interesting is that acidity you can actually taste. And I think this is actually a pretty good specimen if you'd like to give that a shot and tell me what it tastes like.
Mmm, it's yummy. Meg and I have become really fascinated with edible seaweed too, so we'll get into that in a little bit. But maybe we'll just incorporate it into our general discussion here as to which ones are edible.
That's really good. It's almost a little spicy.
You taste the sour in there, the acidity? Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, it's pretty acidic. And so so kind of on that note, since we're talking about it, I will tell you that all seaweed is edible. There is not a poisonous one that will harm you and whatnot. Although, depending on the area you collect it from, it could get contaminated.
Yeah.
As I mentioned to my students yesterday, seaweed do not bioaccumulate biotoxins like clams collecting harmful algae. Uh-huh. But they do because they're plants. They concentrate heavy metals. So that's the thing to look out for. Of course, if you collect it from, you know, area, there's a lot of bird poop, you can get sick that way too. So make sure it's washed and whatnot. But generally, all seaweed is edible. I will note that not all of it is very palatable. Uh-huh. Some taste better than others. And typically, the most edible kind are the kelp. You know, there actually is a kelp, very widely distributed one called the sugar rack. Uh-huh. You can imagine where that name came from.
Yeah.
So we can talk more about that, and there are very specific regulations regarding harvest of seaweed and how you do it and where you do it. You know, definitely people that are looking to harvest should make sure they have a Fish and Wildlife shellfish and seaweed collection license. They have the license, but also make sure where they're collecting from, it's open for harvest. Seaweed is protected in all state parks, so you can't just go to any state park and harvest, but there are three specific state parks you can harvest from. There's Fort Casey, Fort Flagler, and I can't remember the third one. But look that up. There's also a very specific protocol on harvesting seaweed, because you don't want to just rip up the entire specimen, especially, you know, if it's held fast onto some rock substrate, and they will regrow if harvested properly. So there is general guidance on harvest. In fact, I brought for you today Fish and Wildlife Harvest Regulations, and inside it, I did a printout, and this is put out by Department of Natural Resource. It talks about the best ways to harvest, and it talks about leaving the holdfast and the base of the blade when you harvest so it can regrow.
Uh-huh.
So that is for you.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah, there's a lot to learn, and I'm excited to learn it.
Yeah, absolutely. Since we are on this topic, do you mind if I share with you some things I brought taste? So what I have here is what I call sea puffs. This is rock weed or fucus.
Oh, I've seen those.
Yes, and this is dehydrated. And so they are puffy and crunchy.
Wow.
There you go, Meg. And maybe put them...
And actually, they're beautiful, too.
Yeah. Put the mic up to your mouth and hear the crunch.
Mm, that's great. They're good. They're really good.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so these were just harvested a few days ago. I prepped this for us. I rinsed it in fresh water. It's important to me that I don't soak it, because they tend to experience osmotic stress. They get gooey and stuff if you soak it. So I quickly rinse it to make sure it's clean. And then I just put it in a dehydrator. And this is seasoned with its own salt.
Wow.
That's amazing.
I didn't add any seasoning to it.
How long are you dehydrating?
Oh, until they're dry. This was going for 2 days, but you could eat it after a few hours.
It's so delicious. I know.
So there's that. And there is another a Northwest delicacy here. And there are actually companies in Alaska that do this now that you can buy. But this is pickled bull kelp.
Oh.
This is, I believe this is curry flavored. So, if y'all would like to try a piece,
yes,
I'd love to share this with you.
And it was piece.
Thank you.
There you go.
So.
Yeah, like I mentioned, there's plenty of food here on the beach for us. There you go.
Thank you.
Oh, wow. That's incredible.
That's delicious, too. Mm-hmm. It's really nice with the curry.
Yeah, yeah. So that is the pickled bull kelp bulb and stipe. As I mentioned, though, just now, that you're not supposed to harvest the bulb or stipe.
Mm-hmm.
So I need to specify that this was a specimen that was washed up. This was entire bull kelp that got washed up at North Beach. So, you know, I knew that it wasn't going to grow anymore. It was on North Beach. So that's where I get the bulb and stipe for pickling.
Uh-huh.
Of course, if it was attached to the bottom, I would leave it alone. But, you know, any one of us that's walked North Beach knows after a winter storm, there's plenty of good stuff on there for us to collect.
Yep. At what month do we get to where it's too late to harvest?
So for the washed up bull kelp, there really isn't a limit. There certainly are more. There's more of it in late fall, early winter. But I actually collected this late winter. This is a bull kelp from last year. I know I said it was an annual plant, but some of them persist longer if they don't get torn up by winter storms.
Mm-hmm.
So this was one that was collected in late spring at North Beach.
Wow. So you just put it in vinegar and you add a little bit of curry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wow. Do you can it then? Do you have to pressure?
It's not pressured can. It's just a
water bath.
Hot water bath kind of deal. Yeah. We eat it so fast.
You don't have to worry about keeping it.
No, it goes real quick. It's a party favorite.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, it's really delicious.
Yeah.
So anyway, back to what we're seeing on the ground here. It's hard to not go into, let's more recipes for that seaweed.
Yeah, there's so much of it. And there are a lot of great resources out there. I just say is that it's often under-recognized, and in fact, for those of us, the form of seaweed that most people are familiar with is the nori from sushi.
Yeah.
We have that right over there, and I'll walk you over there and we'll harvest some. It's a different species that we have here as opposed to the one in Japan, but it's still the same genus of Porphyra. So nori right over there, and that's one of the trick ones that look a certain color, but it belongs to another group.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep.
And so we're seeing these long blades here.
Mm-hmm.
Are
this
these
one?
Part of a bull kelp leaf?
So that's a good question. You are on the right track. This is a kelp. This is a type of kelp. You can tell that because it's brown.
Yep.
It's very, you know, when you feel it, it's a lot more robust than the other seaweeds. And you can eat this. Give it a shot. Give it a sample. I like that a lot. That's a really tasty one.
It's crunchy, though. Do people usually eat just the side or the whole thing?
I eat
thing?
All of it.
Uh-huh. A little sample here.
So that's a really tasty one, except this one does not have the identifying feature. So let me find another one of the same species with the identifying feature. Come on. And again, a lot of this is tattered and old, but here we go. Here we go. This is a big specimen of what we were just looking at. You can see that midrib is right here. See that?
Yep.
Midrib? But I'm looking at the base of this one because this one is called the wing kelp. You would think it's called midrib kelp, but there are other midrib kelps. This one's called a wing kelp because at the base of it actually has these wings.
Oh, I see.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
And these wings are the reproductive structures. On this species, this is where the spores come from.
Are the wings just, are they three?
Oh, there are
there
can be
multiple.
Many.
I see.
But this one is the wing kelp or Alaria marginata. A beautiful specimen that is readily collected, and there's a lot of it out here just on the other side of the spit. And
I'm seeing some beautiful seersucker patterned.
This one is the three, I think this one is three or five. This is a five ribbed kelp. I know them more by the scientific names as Costaria costata. Another very good edible one, also edible.
Got just a little sample. I'm gonna give Meg a little sample here.
Thank you.
This is a beautiful one for pressing. I like pressing this one because of these patterns.
And I'm hoping to not forget to mention that NAM also presses seaweed and it does beautiful press specimens that are now on display at the Port Townsend Marine Science Center, right?
In their shop, yeah. I sell some of my pressings in their shop. Right now I'm talking to them with their coordinator, hoping that maybe I can donate some of my pressings to a new exhibit they have that's going to be about kelp. There's a lot of work about kelp, and I'm very glad that there's a lot of attention on kelp nowadays, the importance of kelp to all of the different species I mentioned previously, the decrease of kelp in Puget Sound. There's a lot of focus on it.
And why? Because of, do they know?
There are a lot of reasons, but there is not one clear reason. Uh-huh. It's just like many other declines in the natural world these days. It's kind of death by a thousand cuts. There are a lot of things we're doing that is kind of reducing the water quality and their ability to, you know, persist throughout the year. So there are a lot of reasons, and there's...
An annual? It'll die back?
Bull kelp is. Yeah. And it's really important to specify what we're talking about, because I am talking specifically right now about canopy-forming bull kelp. There are a lot of different species out there, but right now the attention is on Nereocystis luciana, which is bull kelp. There has been a couple of recent publications that Department of Natural Resource, their kelp scientist Helen Berry, put out there. In fact, KUOW and NPR covered that pretty recently. But there is some research that's showing a decrease in kelp in South Sound. And, you know, it's a long publication, but if you look into it, she talks about the various reasons why that is. But yeah, I'm just so glad that there finally is a lot of public attention. There's a lot of funding going into it. And as a result of that, I've heard that the Port Townsend Marine Science Center is going to get some funding to do a kelp exhibit. And I'm really hoping to donate some of my pieces, my pressings, my herbarium collection to that cause, because it's one that's near and close to my heart. And so to that end, I have another surprise for you all. This is a gift I want to give to the Nature Now program.
That's beautiful. Gorgeous.
This is one, just an example of some of my pressings. This is actually three specimens that were collected from this beach. Wow. I believe this is Cryptoplura, which I can point out here. It's a beautiful leafy red. We have a more lacy red here that I believe is Rhodoptilium.
That's gorgeous.
And then we have a sea lace. This is a flattened sea lace, a Odonthalia washingtoniensis.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah. I'll put it up and put your name on it. Refer people to the program where they can hear you talking about these people.
So along those lines, I have two stickers for you and two stickers for Meg here. These are some kelp stickers that I made that is also, I'm available in the Port Townsend Marine Science Center shop. And of course, everything that is, all the proceeds there go to their educational and science programs.
And man, you have been busy.
Wow, thank you.
And you're wearing your beautiful shirt with seaweed. On the back, you've got a beautiful fish with more seaweed.
Yeah, this is an art style called Girataku. It's an ancient Japanese art of fish rubbing. And I did it with kelp on this shirt. And again, those are all, you can see some of that work at the PTMSC shop and hopefully in an exhibit or gallery soon.
Fantastic.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. Thank you so much for the stickers.
Thank you so much. Well, let us go across and look at some more seaweed.
Sure.
Across to another spit, and we're seeing eelgrass. And we also have been seeing some black brant geese that are, eelgrass is one of their favorite foods. So Nam, we're seeing this eelgrass here, and this is rooted in the actual soil here, right?
Yes. So we're in this little eelgrass patch inside the lagoon right out here in Point Hudson here. And, you know, this is the native eelgrass, Zostera marina. It's a pretty nice, robust bed. It persists here. It's been here for as long as I've been in town, for 8 years. And there's a bigger bed that way. But this is in the protected area, you know, that's not as exposed to the wave action. If we walk over there more, we'll get some surf grass. That's the Phyllospadix genus, where they experience more energy. Of course, that's why they're called surf grass. But yeah, you have this beautiful little meadow that, like you mentioned, I'm often watching the brants feeding here in the spring. So great little area.
And eelgrass is a really important place for eggs to be laid also, right?
Yes, absolutely. It's a preferred substrate for herring to spawn on, but there are a ton of different species that utilize it. You know, this is just a nursery habitat that we're standing in for juvenile Dungeness crab, all kinds of different invertebrates. And eelgrass themselves, they change the substrate, the bottom underneath them. And so there's a very specific set of invertebrate infauna, infauna being organisms that live in the ground that are associated with the brants, with the eelgrass. So the brants are not the only birds that feed here. You'll see great blue herons eating some of the infauna invertebrates, some of the birds, juvenile fish that you find here.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Great. Well, let's wander on. Yeah. So we are going to tell us quickly about your favorite things that we're seeing right here.
Sure. I think my favorite thing, again, is just a big view that we have eelgrass and kelp right next to each other. Uh-huh. You don't typically see that. This is, again, one place that you have a lot of overlap of species, and we are just about, you know, shin deep in a eelgrass bed, but also their Alaria wing kelp. There's this really beautiful fine lacy red here. It's just a beautiful little habitat. Yeah. And so that's my favorite thing about this spot. It's just the overlap of all these different species. I don't have to go all over the place to see them all.
Well, and it's right in our backyard. I mean, we are so very lucky. And we're so very lucky to have had you to come out with us. So thank you so much. I can see that Meg and I are like, we want to keep on. We want to do like part 3, part 4, part 5.
Of course.
So we'll hope to get you back, talk more about this great environment.
Yeah,
so thank you so much for having us. And thank you, Meg, for being our recorder.
You're welcome. A pleasure as always.
Thanks for having me. I'm happy to kelp.
That's good.
And here's our mystery sound again. It is the quiet nasal chuckle of a brant. And if you're lucky, you will still see some of these lovely dusky, stocky geese foraging in the tidal flats before they head north for the breeding grounds. We saw a bunch of them feeding at low tide on our field trip near Point Hudson, and they can often be found feeding in flocks there in the winter. The brant is similar in appearance to the Canada goose, but smaller and darker. What immediately stands out about them is their black neck and head with a thin white necklace. Brant are almost exclusively coastal in their range and are found in shallow bays and saltwater marshes. They nest in the wet coastal tundra of the high Arctic. Their winter habitat is closely tied to the occurrence of seagrasses and marine algae. Historically, brant fed almost exclusively on eelgrass, which is still strongly preferred when available. Now they also forage on grasslands and have been able to diversify their diet in the absence of eelgrass, though their range is still closely tied to eelgrass. Brant also eat some aquatic invertebrates. No other goose nests as far north as the brant, and few migrate as far. During this trek, brant fly at altitudes of several thousand feet. The West Coast population breeds primarily on Melville Island and Prince Patrick Island in the western high Arctic. They then travel to Eisenbeck Lagoon in Alaska, where they stage in the hundreds of thousands for over a month before heading to wintering grounds in Puget Sound and as far south as Baja. A population of around 400 individuals usually spend November through mid-May with us before heading north to breed. Several of our fine local naturalists have been helping us understand more about our brant population by looking for banded individuals among the birds that visit us each winter. Jeff Hammerson has been meticulously gathering information for several years, finding that most are from breeding areas on the north slope of Alaska or on the Yukon Delta. He has photographed over 40 banded brant off our shores, several of these returning year after year to the same location. Our friends Hillary Smith and Wendy Feltham have also become brant enthusiasts and are adding to the database with their great photos. To learn more, go to the wonderful online journal rainshadownorthwest.com and look for Wendy's recent article on brant. complete with some of her gorgeous photos. And look also for Jeff's great book, Pacific Flyway, Waterbird Migration from the Arctic to Tierra del Fuego, which also includes stunning photography. And that's it for this edition of Nature Now for mid-May. I would like to thank my guest, Nam Su, from the Washington Department of Wildlife, for taking us on a very fun and informative seaweed field trip, and to Meg Amos for being our recorder and fellow seaweed sampler, to Nora Petrich for her editing prowess, and to all of you for listening. Closing music will be Dulaman, which is Irish for channeled wrack, an edible seaweed of the Irish Sea, which is by the group Celtic Woman. Wishing you, as always, happy trails.
Well, food, I'm well, I'm here, so do the man, my rock. Do the man, the pinna,